welcome to Ruby Rider's Pegging Paradise podcast number 104 on June 4th, 2015. Changing the world one ass at a time. So I received a response to one of the subjects on my last podcast, which was the young man who was afraid of being called gay by his friends. And here's what it says. Ruby, what the boyfriend who doesn't want to be called gay means is he doesn't want to be called unmanly. Gay in this case doesn't really mean homosexual, but is guy talk for unmanly. He doesn't want to be called it because it's hard to respond that you aren't unmanly after it is exposed you get penetrated. It is almost the literal definition of unmanly, as it is typically and historically the woman who is penetrated. It's a silver bullet put down that when used against you, even jokingly when accurate, is like a punch in the chest because you can't refute it. So again, while the word used is gay, it's just code for unmanly and isn't meant to be homophobic. Wow. I mean, I was so floored to receive this and to be able to understand it better. And I really, really appreciate the man who sent this in, because it's sort of like the guy perspective, which I wasn't aware of. I didn't understand the code, but the code makes me sad because, well, if you've been listening to this podcast long enough, you know that my favorite kind of guy is the total masculine manly man, and then the contrast of him giving that all up when I penetrate him in terms of, and when I say giving that all up, it's not that he's any less manly, it's that he allows me in. And opening and allowing someone in takes great strength. And I know that, you know, okay, great, when someone says, dude, you know, you're gay if you like that, you can't sit there, or at least it's a little cumbersome to sit there and say, well, wait a minute, because that actually takes great strength to let someone in, you know, and that kind of thing. It elevates the conversation to a place where they're not even there. But it makes me sad because I have been trying to figure out a way that we can move beyond the he's gay as an insult. Okay, so now I understand the code. It's being called unmanly because you have been penetrated. The measure of strength in a man is not how macho he can pretend to be. It's his strength of character. It's his strength of ethics and things like that, you know, strength of kindness and ability to open up. So I don't know, I could sort of wax poetic on this, but it's getting all esoteric. So let's see. I would love some help from you, my listeners, to try and figure out a response that would work, that would be fitting, that would encompass what we're trying to do here, which is to stop equating penetration with manliness or lack thereof. What can we say in that moment? What can a man say when he has been called gay, implying through the code that he is unmanly because it's just been found out he allows anal penetration? I don't know. The only thing that I can think of is to say, dude, if you haven't tried prostate stimulation, you are fucking missing out, because it's the best orgasms ever, and I don't care what you call me, you should try it. Take the focus off of, oh yes, I am manly, and put it on, really, seriously, you're missing out on all this pleasure? Dude, what is your problem? That's the only thing I can think of. I'm open to suggestions, though, and thank you, sir, for writing in and letting me know the code. Now I get it. And it makes me sad, yes, because wow, we put a lot of pressure on guys, a whole lot of pressure, and living in fear of being called unmanly is a bummer. It totally is. I know that through the Brené Brown talks, one of the things that men are never, ever supposed to appear is weak, and this ties in with everything, you know, because vulnerability is unfortunately equated to weakness, okay? And what is more vulnerable than allowing someone to penetrate you? You know, that's a very vulnerable act to do, but it's not a weak act. So anyway, all right, that's my rant. I'm starting off my podcast with a rant. Let's move right along here. This next one is a very short message I was left on my pegging101.com site. Are there any websites for men who like being pegged? No, there's not. Okay, moving right along. No. Okay, here's the answer to that question. Of course there are. There's peggingparadise.com, there's pegging101.com, but if you are asking, are there any websites for men who like being pegged to hook up with women who like pegging, then my first answer was correct. No, there's not. We've gone over this in other previous podcasts. Your best deal is to find sexually open websites like FetLife.com, AdultFriendFinder.com, things like that, and be very open about what you're looking for. But I do caution whoever you are who wrote in asking this that to lead with, I'm looking for a woman to fuck me in the ass, is really, really annoying to those of us who do like pegging, because it is as if you are trying to find a fetish delivery service. And if that's what you're trying to find, then go hire a pro. And I will put the links to those podcasts in there. How do I find somebody? And why should I go to a pro? I'll put for links to those articles and podcasts. Okay, let's see. Moving right along. This is a message that was sent to me on Reddit. I've looked over a few of your posts, and you look to be something of a pegging expert, so considering my situation, I figured I could ask you. I've been interested in pegging for some time. At first, it was just something I read about, but as I've read more testimonials about how much pleasure you can get from pegging, it's something I've been dying to experience. Over the years, none of my partners have been interested. A few years ago, I met a sexy older woman who was up for being my first, but she turned out to be a tease. Flash forward a few years, now I'm married in a relationship where my partner is not interested, period. Do you know a way I can experience pegging solo? I'm sure it won't be the experience I've wanted with another person, but at this point, I can't wait any longer. Thanks for taking your time to read this, and any advice you could send my way would be appreciated. Wow. Okay. So here is the advice I have. First, I have to say, I love how you are trying to find alternatives, that you are trying to find a way you can satisfy this desire yourself. And here are my two suggestions. They're both different kinds of toys. One is a dildo with a suction cup base, okay? And I don't know what level of anal exploration you have done with yourself. So the first thing that I would recommend would be to read the article I wrote about solo exploration, and it will give you some guidance as far as exploring your ass for the first time, in case that is the place that you find yourself at right now. And then from there, let's get back to what I started to say, which is that there are dildos with suction cup bases. Particularly, the Blush Novelties line has excellent suction cup bases, and they're also dual density, which makes them really nicely soft with a rigid core for functionality. These are excellent toys to use in the shower. That is one option that you have. Another option would be to buy one of the double-ended dildos. The reason I suggest this is because reaching down there with a toy can sometimes be really awkward. Reaching down there with your fingers can be awkward. So to have a toy that has enough length on it and to have the correct angles is a delightful thing. And what I have been told about the doubles is that the bulb that normally fits into the woman makes an excellent handle to be able to fuck yourself. So those would be my two basic suggestions. I mean, you can get a little more intense than that and actually buy yourself a fucking machine, but I have heard from men who buy those varying reports. Some of them say that they're awesome, and there's a fair amount of them that say it's just a machine that goes back and forth. There's no variation. There's no human connection, but I know that you have resolved that it's okay to not have that. But that's a lot of money to spend for something that just goes back and forth. And if you have a toy that you can use yourself, that would be something you can change the angle, the speed. You know, it's masturbation at its best, I guess I would say. So those would be my two suggestions for you. And I'm going to put links to those toys as well that I mentioned. One more toy I'll mention is the Enjoy Pure Wand. That is a little different from feeling like you're getting fucked, but it is a very, very effective and magical prostate stimulation toy that is easy to use on yourself. It's easy for women to use for G-spot, and it's easy for men to use for prostate stimulation. So let me put the links to those three. It depends on how you masturbate, where you picture yourself, where you have the time and the privacy to indulge in this, whether it's just in the shower, whether it's in the bedroom. See my points? That will probably affect your choice of toys. So let us know how it goes. Oh, and if you are, if when you get these toys, you find yourself wanting to find out more about the different kinds of orgasms that are possible, I will also put yet another link, because I link to this all the time, the Eneros Forum, where there's a whole bunch of guys talking about the different kinds of orgasms you can have with prostate stimulation. So thank you for writing in, sir. Okay, this is a message I got on FetLife. Let's see. I know you have a lot of knowledge with pegging, and I would think most likely about the prostate itself and about the importance of PSA screenings for men. I'm going through a waiting period right now. I'm trying to get as much information as I can about this due to just being told I possibly have prostate cancer and will need to have the biopsy procedure done soon. This came about from recent routine physical and blood work, and the PSA numbers showed a little above the normal range and had always been on the lower side. I don't know too much about this, but I did find out from the urologist men don't have to have any symptoms at all. I always thought that there were symptoms first. I figured with all your podcasts and different discussions and the knowledge you have around pegging pleasure that you may have some information on the prostate and the pros and cons around treatment too. I thought it might be a good subject for health awareness that many men and women are not aware of. It is same for colonoscopy screening and the importance of having them too. I just had one recently. What are the different ways for treatment? How important are the prostate screenings and the risks associated when having invasive screenings and biopsies after? I know you're not a doctor, but thought you might have covered this or had some information in this area. If you haven't, it might be good for awareness and possibly can save lives too. Any information is greatly appreciated during this time. Wow. So, I have tried three different times to record some things about this, and what basically ended up happening is that I kept going further down the rabbit hole and learning more things. So let me tell you what I have learned in my dive down the rabbit hole about PSA screenings for early detection of prostate cancer and the subsequent treatment. First of all, there is a governmental agency called the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, AHRQ. And in 1998, the U.S. Congress authorized the AHRQ to convene a task force to provide ongoing scientific, administrative, and dissemination support to the task force. So, okay, let's make that into English. This task force is 16 volunteer members who are nationally recognized experts in prevention, evidence-based medicine, and primary care. And what they are tasked to do is to make a report to Congress that identifies critical evidence gaps in research related to preventative services and recommends priority areas that deserve further examination. So what ends up happening here is they take a look at things like recommendations like every man should over the age of 50 should have a PSA screening every year. And for example, and what they found, these 16 experts, is they rate the recommendations. They give it a letter grade based on the strength of the evidence and the balance of benefits or harms of a preventative service, right? So, and the recommendations apply only to people who have no signs or symptoms of the specific disease or condition under evaluation. So, if you have a bunch of suspicious symptoms and are considering getting a PSA test, then you should get the PSA test. This only applies to people who have no signs or symptoms of the disease or condition. So, with that background, let me tell you that in May of 2012, they released their recommendation that They do not recommend. They recommend against prostate-specific antigen, which is PSA-based screening for prostate cancer. And they gave that preventative screening test a D. So what does a D mean? When you look at the wording for the D, the task force recommends against this service. There is moderate or high certainty that the service has no net benefit or that the harms outweigh the benefits. Suggestions for the practice discourage the use of this service. That was in May of 2012. And keep in mind that this task force is independent. The government put it together, but these are independent people with, ideally, you know, no agenda one way or another, other than to try and make sure that these tests that we do are necessary and are actually helping rather than hurting. So I looked up on the website that is for the National Cancer Institute. So it's cancer.gov, and there is a fact sheet on prostate-specific antigen test, PSA, right? And it's interesting because they get pretty detailed about it. They are fairly open about the fact that there are harms and there are risks to this PSA screening. Okay, so you know what that made me think of, first of all, is what kind of test is it? Are you, you know, what are you doing to people that it's that risky? The test itself is not risky. It's drawing blood. It's determining the level of that specific antigen in your blood. So there's no risk as far as the test being done. It's what happens after the test that carries all the risk. So I'm going to talk about that in a minute. First, let me tell you that I found an interview with the guy who discovered the antigen. Okay, now, don't mistake me and think that I'm talking about the guy who discovered the test. This is the guy that discovered the antigen itself. Now, when he was studying it, what he found was that the PSA levels were elevated in someone who had already been treated for cancer in terms of predicting whether that cancer had reoccurred, but he never intended it to be used as a cancer screening device, as a predictive measure of whether this person had cancer or not. So there's that. And I'm just repeating what he said in interviews and things. He actually wrote a book as well, but to go further with some of the things that he said he had no idea how the PSA test ever got approved by the FDA because it's 75 to 80% false positives. That's one point that I found. Here's another point that'll blow your mind. And this is reading directly from the interview. He says, "We can't tell the difference between latent cancer or non-clinical cancer and aggressive cancer. I make the analogy in the book of a rabbit and a turtle in an open box. The turtle crawls around the box and goes nowhere. That's the non-aggressive, indolent cancer. The rabbit, representing the aggressive cancer, can jump out of the box and metastasize any time. The problem is we can't tell the difference between a rabbit and a turtle. The most important crux is that prostate cancer is an age-related disease. If you get, for example, 100 men, black or white, between the ages of 60 and 69 years old, and do biopsies, you will find that 65% of these men have prostate cancer because it's age-related." And then the other person interviewing him goes on to say, "But it's rarely aggressive." So the book I mentioned before, yes, the man who discovered the antigen has actually written a book. And the name of the book is The Great Prostate Hoax: How Big Medicine Hijacked the PSA Test and Caused a Public Health Disaster. Wow. So this kind of blew my mind because this is the guy who actually discovered the antigen. Now, there has actually been studies as well. One U.S. study and one European study. The U.S. study showed that there was no benefit. In other words, a greater percentage of men did not survive prostate cancer between the control group and the group with the screenings. When they talk about the harm that was done, when I went back to say, you know, it's not the test itself being done because that's just a simple blood test, it's what's done after. Well, what's done after is a series of things. The first usually is perhaps an ultrasound, and that really isn't going to cause any harm. But after that, there's a biopsy that's done. And many times if the biopsy shows cancerous cells, which, as I talked about, the quote from the doctor who discovered this antigen saying that if you do biopsies of guys who are between 60 and 69, a whole bunch of them are going to have cancerous cells because it's an age-related disease. Well, then what's the next thing that's going to happen? They can't tell the difference between an aggressive one and a non-aggressive one. So, of course, it's like, we should make sure that this is not something cancerous that's going to invade your entire body, so let's remove your prostate. Let's do a prostatectomy, let's do the radiation, let's do all that stuff, right? So the side effects of that can include urinary incontinence, erectile dysfunction, difficulty in bowel movements because of the radiation treatment, and in rare cases, even death. So that's a lot of harm, actually. See, the problem here is that they're doing these tests on the older men, and the older men are the ones that usually do have prostate cancer, even though it is a form of cancer that was so slow growing that it would never give them a problem for the rest of their lives because they're older. And instead of allowing that to run its course and never be a problem, it's turned into a problem. I also found out in my reading, a high PSA level does not mean that the person has cancer. A low PSA level does not mean that the person does not have cancer. You can have someone who has a very aggressive cancer with a really low PSA, and you can have someone who has no cancer whatsoever with a very high PSA. So, it seems as if this use as a screening device is quite questionable, and this man that discovered the antigen makes the case that it was all the doing of a drug company that wanted to push this as a screening device. And then, flash forward to the task force that looks at it and gives it a D rating and says, no, we do not recommend this. But unfortunately, not a whole lot of things have changed. With MDs, I don't know whether the word doesn't get around, whether they're afraid of malpractice suits if they don't do the PSA test, and then the patient comes down with cancer. But one of the things that I read in a different place on the internet, and let me find that so I can tell you exactly where it is, and I'm going to have links to all of these, and I think I've learned so much that I'm probably going to even do a special podcast all about the prostate. This is from an article in the New York Times, October of 2011. And the chairman of that task force said about the PSA test, this test cannot tell the difference between cancers that will and will not affect a man during his natural lifetime. We need to find one that does. Here's another part of the article. As the PSA test has grown in popularity, the devastating consequences of the biopsies and treatments that often flow from the test have become increasingly apparent. From 1986 through 2005, 1 million men received surgery, radiation therapy, or both, who would not have been treated without a PSA test, according to the task force. Among them, at least 5,000 died soon after surgery, and 10,000 to 70,000 suffered serious complications. Half had persistent blood in their semen, and 200,000 to 300,000 suffered impotence, incontinence, or both. As a result of these complications, Richard Ablin, who is the man who discovered it, who in 1970 discovered a prostate-specific antigen, has called its widespread use a public health disaster. Well, this is pretty intense. So, he wrote a book, and I told you about that. And in the interview, it said that when the book came out, that actually there were no lawsuits, no raising a fuss or anything. It was actually largely ignored. So the question would be now, why do they still use this test? And here is, let me be real clear here. If there are signs that someone might have prostate cancer, if there are suspicious signs, then the test is, of course, one of the things that you might use to try and find out what's going on. But here's another paragraph from this article. Not knowing what is going on with one's prostate may be the best course, since few men live happily with the knowledge that one of their organs is cancerous. Autopsy studies show that a third of men ages 40 to 60 have prostate cancer, a share that grows to 3/4 after age 85. Of the trials conducted to assess the value of PSA testing, the two largest were conducted in Europe and the United States. Both, quote, demonstrate that if any benefit does exist, it is very small after 10 years, according to the task force draft recommendation statement. So there you have it. I think that whether or not to get a PSA test deserves an enormous amount of consideration and educating yourself to make sure that you know the risks as opposed to the benefits. I think that there's a tremendous amount of fear driving all of this, and it is the fear of malpractice on the part of the doctors, most likely, but there's also a tremendous amount of fear driving the decisions of the men who are diagnosed with prostate cancer. Are you willing to roll those dice and say, I don't think it's the aggressive kind? You know, who would make that decision? And of course, the doctors are there ready to do the surgery. Wow. Okay, here's another thing you might hear talked about. It's called the Gleason scale. Or actually, I think it's called the Gleason score. There's a way that when they do biopsies, they test it somehow and come up with what they call a Gleason score. I didn't dive quite deep enough down that part of the rabbit hole to find out how they test it, because it gets pretty medically specific, physiologically specific, microbiology specific, perhaps. But the abstract that I found in, the Journal of Urology in 2006, of April 2006, said, this is a 20-year follow-up of a population based in Sweden, and the question was, how well does the Gleason score predict prostate cancer death? Conclusions. Although a high Gleason score is a determinant of prostate cancer death, its positive predictive value is relatively low. That phrase means the probability that a patient with a positive test result really does have the condition for which the test was conducted. Thus, further efforts in finding other or complementary indicators of prostate cancer outcome are needed. So it sounds like it's the PSA thing all over again. Using a test to predict something that it is not good at predicting and is very inaccurate. So I ran across a bunch of places where people are leaving comments on articles saying, hey, I had a Gleason score of 7, and so I'm lucky to be here today, as if it was a very clear determinant of the fast-growing cancer after the biopsy. So what it sounds like to me is that a whole bunch of guys are having their prostates ripped out unnecessarily. I'm not a doctor. I might get a lot of flack for this because something that I found in the New York Times article was a couple of things. One is, even for men who do have fast-growing cancer, the PSA test may not save them since there is no proven benefit to earlier treatment of such invasive disease. Okay, and the last thing I'm going to read you from this article is, advocates for those with prostate cancer promise to fight the recommendation. Tens of thousands of men believe a PSA test saved their lives. And it says, the bottom line is that this is the best test we have, and the answer can't be don't get tested, which is a really interesting thing to say, because if the test doesn't work, why would you do it? So let's go back to talking about the task force, the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force. They actually have a PDF called Talking with Your Patients About Screening for Prostate Cancer. They had a tab for consumers, and they had a tab for physicians. And so I finally clicked the tab for physicians, and I thought maybe it would be something with a degree of physiological specificity that I wouldn't understand, but this is what I found. And it actually boils everything down to such a succinct outlay of information that I'm just going to read this to you, because I know some of you won't click the link. Some of you won't go to my blog and click the link. So check this out. Talking with your patients about screening for prostate cancer. After conducting a comprehensive review of the medical evidence, including the results of recent large clinical trials on May 22, 2012, the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force issued a final recommendation statement on PSA screening. This fact sheet will help you discuss PSA screening for prostate cancer. This recommendation applies to men of all ages. It does not include the use of the PSA test for monitoring in men who have been diagnosed with or who are being treated for prostate cancer. And then it goes to possible benefit of screening. In an unscreened population, about 5 out of every 1,000 men will die from prostate cancer after 10 years. Results of several large trials have shown that at best, PSA screening may help 1 man in 1,000 avoid death from prostate cancer after at least 10 years. Most likely, the number helped is even smaller. That means that with PSA screening, 4 to 5 out of every 1,000 men will die from prostate cancer after 10 years. Expected harms of screening. First category is false positive results. About 100 to 120 of every 1,000 men screened receive a false positive test. Most positive tests result in biopsy and can cause worry and anxiety. Up to 1/3 of men undergoing biopsy will experience fever, infection, bleeding, urinary problems, and pain that they consider a moderate or major problem. 1% will be hospitalized for these complications. Second category is overdiagnosis. In most cases, prostate cancer does not grow or cause symptoms. If it does grow, it usually grows so slowly that it is not likely to cause health problems during a man's lifetime. Currently, it is not possible to reliably distinguish indolent from aggressive cancers. Many cancers diagnosed would have remained asymptomatic for life and do not require treatment. Third category, overtreatment. Because of the uncertainty about which cancers need to be treated, 90% of men with prostate cancer found by PSA choose to receive treatment. Many of these men cannot benefit from treatment because their cancer will not grow or cause health problems. Harms of treatment include erectile dysfunction from surgery, radiation therapy, or hormone therapy. Urinary incontinence from radiation therapy or surgery, a small risk of death and serious complications from surgery, 2 serious cardiovascular events per 1,000 men screened, 1 case of pulmonary embolus or deep venous thrombosis, 1 perioperative death per every 3,000 men screened. And then it goes on a little bit further to talk about responding to questions from your patients about PSA testing. If your patient does raise the issue of PSA screening, or if you believe his individual circumstances warrant consideration of PSA screening, be sure to discuss it with him thoroughly so he can make an informed decision. The United States, it's the acronym, the USPSTF, strongly recommends that you do not order a PSA test without such a discussion. The decision to start or continue PSA screening should reflect your patient's understanding of the possible benefits and expected harms, and should respect his preferences. And then another subtitle, points to discuss with your patients who have questions. Explain the facts about prostate cancer and what is involved in PSA testing. Use the previous page or the information sources below. Describe the benefits and harms not only of PSA screening itself, but a potential subsequent diagnostic testing and treatment. Once you've explained the facts, make sure your patient's decision about PSA testing fits with his preferences and values. One way to do this is to describe several men and ask which one your patient identifies with most. Tailor your discussion to meet those needs, preferences, and values. It then goes on to list 3 different patient scenarios: man number 1, man number 2, and man number 3. And I don't need to read all those. But the whole point here is that this is a test that has been shown actually to cause more harm than good. Okay, so I found this next thing in an article called "Can Cancer Ever Be Ignored?" And this was actually an article that was written in 2011, right before the U.S. Task Force came out with their recommendation that PSA is not a test that they recommended is helpful. And let me just read you this one paragraph that shows you how sometimes decisions are made that absolutely do not take into account and focus on the health of the American public. Really, what's happening here is the bottom dollar. So here we go. So what should a man do when his doctor suggests a routine PSA test? The U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, a panel of independent experts that evaluates the latest scientific evidence on preventative tests and treatments, is charged with making recommendations in just such situations. It already recommends against routine screening for men over 75. According to an internal document, in 2009, the task force conducted an in-depth analysis of data and seemed poised to give routine PSA testing a D rating, D as in don't do it, for any man of any age. But this was around the time that the task force stated that routine mammography for women ages 40 to 50 was not necessary for every woman. That recommendation caused a public uproar. And Ned Kalong, the task force chairman at the time, sent the PSA recommendation back for review. 1 year later, in November 2010, just before midterm elections, the task force was again set to review its recommendation when Kalong canceled the meeting. He says that word leaked out that if the November meeting was held, it could jeopardize the task force's financing. Kenneth Lynn, the researcher who led the review, quit his job in protest. And now, nearly 2 years after its initial finding, it remains uncertain when the task force will release its rating for PSA screening, which we now know was done in 2012. So there you go. It's all about the bottom dollar, isn't it? Ah, this just makes me so angry. Oh my God. How many men got unnecessary treatment because of that? Anyway. Okay. I will put the link to that article in the Linkorama as well. So why doctors are still recommending it or doing it without asking their patients if they would like a PSA test is beyond me. And so I've dove down the rabbit hole so far that I'm going to stop now. And to my friend who asked me this question, this is perhaps not what you expected, but this is what I found. I'm going to be following this closely because, as you all know, prostates are near and dear to my heart. If there's any way that I can help you guys take care of them, I'm in it. I'm on it. I'm with it. I'm going to talk about it, okay? Even if it's not politically correct, even if there's all kinds of money and political funding and crap behind the decisions of talking about what's not working here, I don't care. I'm going to talk about it anyway. Thank you for sending me that message. And I hope this was helpful to you. Okay, the next letter I have is a good one. You want to know why? Because it is pegging celebration time. My wife pegged me for the first time last night after months of joking and talking about it. She wore a fused tango with a Jacques harness, and all I can do today is think about how great it felt. She seemed to really like bending me over and dominating me. She had a couple of intense orgasms before I came, which proves to me she really liked it. We tried a few different positions, like missionary and me on top. We found out that doggy style, or me standing up bent over, are our best positions. After it was over, we figured out that, while she has always wanted to know what having a penis felt like, and the new toy gave her a good idea, not being able to feel the head made it difficult for her to know if it was in, and also made it difficult for her to control thrusting angle and depth. With me bent over, she had the full control she needed. We both liked it a lot, and we're definitely going to keep it on our menu of kinky sexual things to do to each other. Thanks for all of the guidance on your site. While my wife has joked around for years about wanting to know what it felt like to have a penis and how she wanted to play anal games with me, your site gave me some good tips about talking to her about it, toy selection, and actual techniques. Ha ha! I celebrate you guys. That's totally awesome. That's why I played the music for you. And I find it way cool that you guys have experimented with the different positions to see which ones you like the best. The bending over the bed thing, yeah, a lot of guys say that that gives such lovely direct prostate stimulation that they really, really enjoy it. And your body sizes and leg lengths and things must be similar for you to do the doggy well. I'm glad that works for you too. So I'm happy you found the information you needed on my website, and how fun for you both that, well, yeah, how fun for her, definitely, with her couple of orgasms, but how fun for you both that you get to explore this whole new area of sexuality. So have fun with that. Thanks for writing in. And I always love to get letters that let me play the music, sir. So thanks again. Okay, this next letter came in through an email sent via my ruby@peggingparadise.com. Ruby, I love you and what you are doing here. Oh, he starts off saying, I love you. I love this. Okay. My lovely, wonderful wife of 42 years and I are both 65. We recently started to explore the wonderful world of ass play, and I am wondering why we waited so long. I recently heard you on a podcast, and that is what brought me here. But that is not what led us to her pegging me. I have so much to say about this wonderful new exciting activity. I would love to share our experience with you and your readers, but I will only do so if I am certain it will be published. I must say at least that when I orgasm with her strap-on in my ass, it is like no other orgasm I have ever experienced. I shiver, shake, and explode with pleasure. I am left weak, my knees are shaking, and I am thoroughly spent. Pegging is wonderful on so many levels. As I said, I have lots to say about it, but I want to leave with this for now. You are never too old to try and enjoy this. It has reinvigorated our bedroom play, and I can't get enough of it. Weehaw! Okay, I can't promise you publishing in terms of, like, you know, in a book. I can promise you that if you share your experiences with me, I will make sure and get it up on this podcast and read it here. And probably I will post it on my blog as well. I'd love to put it in both places, because I definitely have a section of, like, guest bloggers and readers write in that I have on my blog, as well as loving to read experiences that people write in on my podcast. So please do write in. I'm thrilled that no matter when you discovered it, that you both discovered this is so much fun. So yes, I'm going to reply to your email in case you don't listen to this podcast, and encourage you to send in your experiences. And thanks for writing in, sir. And have fun with that wife of yours. Alrighty, here's another one. This one came from Reddit. I've only just started down the road with ass play after a drunken episode with the missus. I always find your opinions valuable and well thought out. I recently started trying to get a dry orgasm, as everyone keeps saying they are earth-shattering, but I can't seem to get there myself. The wife is going to have a go and see if we can get one together. By any chance, do you have any hints or advice on how to make this happen? I am not pent up on it and realize it may take some practice, but after reading your blogs, I figured you might have some good pointers other than relax and lube. Is there a technique or certain thing you've found the blokes like more often than not? Cheers from an excited Aussie fella. I love this. I love it. And I would love it even more if I could hear you read it aloud with your lovely accent. So if you have another question in the future, sir, please do think of calling in at 805-500-6544. It shouldn't cost you too much to call from Australia, right? Do it from Skype. Okay, so yes, here are my recommendations of what people have said that encourage the hands-free orgasm, the Holy Grail. One is abstinence. Do not have ejaculations and sex for a while. One is edging. Bring yourself up to the brink of orgasm and don't let yourself come. Do that before you go for the full-on Holy Grail, right? And the last one that has popped up lately, pun intended, right, is to clench your anal sphincter while you are getting fucked, basically. That has really made a difference. And I've seen that mentioned in different forums, and other men step up to say, yes, this really made a huge difference in the amount of pleasure that they were feeling. I think initially when guys get fucked in the ass, there's this whole relax thing, which is critical because when you're being anally penetrated, it's so important to be relaxed. However, once you're pretty comfortable with it, once you've been fucked a bunch and you really like it, try tightening that sphincter. Try gripping that toy that's going in and out of you and see if that doesn't increase the pleasure, because that is one more thing that has been mentioned as something that assists in a dry orgasm, a hands-free orgasm, that, whatever term you wish to use for that, a prostate orgasm. And good luck, and let us know how it goes. And when you let us know how it goes, please do call in with that lovely accent. Thanks for writing in, and good luck to you, sir. Okay, this is an email I got. And actually, let me give you the preface and tell you what transpired in the first email. The first email that I received from this woman talked about her boyfriend loved enormous-sized dildos. And she was asking for some advice to try and find good ones of good quality, because they can be hard to find, okay? I mentioned the two that Tantus offer. One is called the Amsterdam, and the other is called the Haas. The Amsterdam is slightly smaller and differently shaped. We do offer both of those on enticeme.com if you'd like to see what they look like. I'll put the links there. And the Haas is the larger one, and it does resemble a cock with balls. So her boyfriend had been doing anal play ever since he was young, and he did have the ability, plus really took great enjoyment in taking very, very large size toys. And she was wondering how to handle that with a harness, because when you get toys that big, there are a lot of considerations. Normal harnesses really don't do that good of a job of fitting, basically, because the O-ring is not big enough for enormous size toys. And she really did want to have the experience of strapping this enormous toy on to her and fucking him, okay? So just as an experiment, as a suggestion to see if it would work, what I did was I sent her the instructions on how to make a do-it-yourself harness out of scarves. This Midori is the one who figured this out. Midori, the genius when it comes to shibari and rope and bondage and things. And I'll put the link for that. It is descriptive. It does not have pictures, so you have to read the words and envision it and make it. Well, apparently this woman did a great job of it, and here is what she wrote me. Hi, Ruby. Good news. The Amsterdam and Midori's scarf harness are a grand success together. I first tried the scarf harness on a smaller dildo and found that it felt so connected to my body, I was in heaven. I then tried it on the Amsterdam. The scarf cinched it firmly to my body and held the weight perfectly. Amazing. I may never go back to the leather harness. Thank you for your information. I am forever grateful. Oh my gosh, that's so awesome, because the Amsterdam is a freaking huge toy, man. I'm so glad it worked for you. And to have the feedback of how comfortable it was and also that it felt so connected to your body is lovely. I'm grateful to you for relaying that, because that's one of the things that makes it better for me, is when that toy feels like it's a part of me. And some harnesses give me that feel and some harnesses don't. Interestingly enough, sometimes the most beautiful harnesses are not the ones that make me feel that way. They're just pretty. So, scarves. Excellent. Okay, that link goes up on the Linkorama. Woohoo! Good for you. I'm glad it worked, and I know your boyfriend is too. All right, this next one came from my pegging101.com site, and it was a comment to a letter that was written in that I responded to. And the letter from this woman was, the name of the article, kind of tells the story. It's called No Fun for Her Yet. And she was struggling mightily with the whole concept of pegging, and really that she didn't enjoy it and her husband really wanted it. And they had reached an impasse, and it was very, very, very difficult for them. And I never want to imply that pegging is for everyone. I am so passionate about it that, of course, I think it can save the world. But we're all different. Some people are going to like it, some people aren't. And this woman absolutely did not. So we had some conversation about that. And I'm going to put the link to that article, because it's always good to hear both sides of things. It's not black and white. It's not you either like it or you don't. Sometimes you hate it, sometimes you love it, and there's lots and lots of area in between. So this man was responding to her letter and my comments, and I did read this woman's letter and answer it on a previous podcast, so you podcast listeners might remember this woman. Anyway, here is his comment. I don't usually leave comments on anything, but kind of felt like I had to on this topic because it sounds like my situation. I'll try and keep it as short as possible. I used to be one of those men that even brushing a hand near my butt would freak me out. After agreeing to allow my wife to use a finger about a year ago, things have progressed to full-on pegging, and I can't get enough. I'm not gay or bi, but I will take pegging anytime over anything else. For me, it's not really the sensation or the great amount of pleasure, but rather being submissive, knowing my wife is in charge and I have no control over things. Simply put, being her little bitch. Maybe that's how your boyfriend was feeling. Now, on the other side of the coin, pegging is not something my wife enjoys, not her cup of tea, and she has said so. However, she does it anyways from time to time. I do pester her about it a lot, just because she knows how much I like it. Most people say, don't do anything uncomfortable when it comes to sex, but I disagree. We all do things we don't like or are not comfortable with because we know it pleases our partner. Straight out denying something your partner likes is just asking them to cheat or asking for unhealthy relationship. At least that's my 2 cents. I kind of agree with this and I kind of don't. Once again, there's lots of territory in what you just said. It is really nice to know that despite the fact you totally love it more than anything else, and that she really doesn't enjoy it that much, that you have found a great compromise, and that it seems to be working for you, that she does you every once in a while, and you love it, and clearly there's other parts of your sexual world that you share together. When you said the part about, you know, everybody does something that's uncomfortable, it's funny, my mind went to giving a blowjob and your neck hurts, or something like that, you know? Or a guy doing cunnilingus and his neck hurts, and being down there for a really long time because you know your partner loves it. And being uncomfortable, like physically, literally uncomfortable, is different than being emotionally uncomfortable, doing something that you have an emotional reaction to, a bad emotional reaction to. Something that kind of disgusts you, perhaps, or just makes you uncomfortable in a I don't like this role reversal thing. Those two types of uncomfortable are different, so I just wanted to point that out. But to a certain point, I agree with you, as long as it's not what feels like a hard limit. And I guess everybody needs to decide that for themselves, what that hard limit term means. For me, one of the things that's a hard limit for me is I'm not interested in any kind of needle play. No one's going to stick needles in me, and I have no interest in sticking needles in other people. So, okay, that's a hard limit for me. If someone wanted me to do it, you know, no, I think you can go somewhere else and get that, but you know, I'm not interested in it. And yes, in the BDSM world, that is actually something that people enjoy. More power to them. There's lots of things that people enjoy, and we all need to make our decisions about what we want to do and what we don't. But as I recall, this woman who wrote in, goodness, she was freaking out. She was in tears, and that's definitely a bad emotional reaction. So to try and push past that, which it sounds like she actually did try and push past it, and still have those reactions and come away hating it, and that is going to do nothing but build a huge aversion to sex, period. So yeah, not on both sides of it, but I appreciate your 2 cents. Absolutely. It is interesting to know that you were one of those guys where, you know, put a hand near your butt and you're like, get that out of here. And now you love pegging. Thanks for giving us that little tidbit. And thanks for writing in. Okay, a comment on my pegging101.com site. I've been married for 9 years now, and me and my wife tried out so many things just to spice up the sex life. Not that it needed any. But if it's going good, why not make it better? So I brought up the idea of pegging, and the wife was keen on trying it out, which I am very glad she did. Started out the small size strap-on for the beginners, and she just loved it. After several times, we decided to go bigger. Bigger is better. I see now why women have these debates. There is no words to describe the look on her face when she penetrates me as I'm laying on my back. She loves to take control of every opportunity, and by control I mean really pounding away with her hands on my hips. Very nice letter that you wrote in. Very nice comment. I appreciate your letting us know that and being so descriptive and starting out small. And so you are a size king, it sounds like. Yeah, some women love big cocks. Some women really could take them or leave them, and some women hate them. And the same thing is true with women and their strap-ons fucking guys in the ass. You will find all different ways of looking at it. So yes, there is a bit of a debate going on, and I suppose, you know, it'd be interesting to find out what it would be like to get the men who have that debate of bigger is better versus, you know, bigger is not better, and the women, and put us all together, and we can talk about size and fucking and have a great time. Thank you for writing in, sir. And now we have another pegging celebration time. So I played the music for you, sir, despite the fact that of your dissatisfaction with what happened after the first time. But let's read your letter. I tried pegging with my wife a few weeks ago. It was very erotic and pleasurable. We have a Tantus fire, and she said it was tough to get into a good motion. I do want to do this again, and I find myself craving it, but my wife is hesitant. What is the best way to go about this? We've played around with the Aneros, and she has no problem with that, but the strap-on, she seems to be hesitant. So I played the music for you, sir, because, despite the fact that your wife seems hesitant now that you've done it, you deserve to have the music played because you actually got to the point where you did it. So congratulations on the two of you trying it out for the first time, and now I'm going to give you some advice. Very first thing I'm going to suggest to you is communication. This is a common suggestion when people write in for advice. It would be great if you could sit down with her and ask her what the hesitancy is about. To prepare you for that conversation, I am going to run through a bunch of possibilities, okay? First of all, pegging is a steep learning curve. And when you mention in your very short message, you didn't give me too much information, it was tough to get into a good motion. Absolutely, it's tough to get into a good motion. We've never had a cock. We don't know how to fuck with them. We don't know how to move. And so it does feel very awkward, and it can be really difficult. If you go back a few podcasts to my interview with Tiffany, it was the very first time she'd ever fucked a guy with a strap on. And I said, if you could condense it down to one word, what would that be? And her word was hard. It's hard. Okay? So there can be a lot of joy in all of this for a woman as well. But in the beginning, the learning curve is steep because it is somewhat of an athletic event. And you men out there know what I mean. Fucking is an athletic event if you are the one doing the fucking, right? So we don't know that. And so we strap one on and all of a sudden your stomach muscles get sore. Your thighs are burning. It's hard to keep balance. You know, all these things are a possibility. Plus, even if you're in incredible shape and you don't have any problems with all that, the motion is not natural, okay? Guys have had cocks and they've been fucking things ever since they figured out how to do it and got a chance. This is the first time she put one on and fucked you, okay? This is the first time she's fucked anybody. So it's going to be awkward. It's going to be weird. So here's what I suggest. I suggest that you do this in positions that will allow her the least amount of effort and require the least amount of skill. Positions for beginners. The easiest and best one is cowboy, where she's laying on her back, she's got the strap on, and you're on your knees and you mount that thing and you ride her and you fuck yourself. It's cool because it's also intimate. You have eye contact. It's also cool because your cock is right there. So if you or she would like to do cock stimulation, that is possible as well. It's a really fun one. So she can just kind of lay back a little bit and it doesn't require as much from her, okay? And another one, if you have a nice, sturdy, wooden, armless chair in your home, is her sitting in the chair with the strap on, and you face her, sit in her lap, and mount that thing. Ideally, the chair has a higher back because you're going to be reaching over her shoulders to that chair back, and that will be part of your balance to ride her. This is a little bit more difficult than the laying on the bed cowboy thing, but again, it is one that does not require much skill or effort on her end. I think she's hesitant because it's hard and she's unsure. So I would be very, very supportive and encouraging. Again, if I can reference the interview with Tiffany, her guy was giving her hints and being really understanding about how, yes, it is a little difficult. And see, you know, when I do this with you, it creates this way that it's very easy for me to just move you around and fuck you. So you can be a bit of a gentle teacher with her, if you will, like Tiffany's guy was with her. Okay, so that's one thing. One is that it kind of freaked her out to strap a cock on. Some women have pretty rigid ideas of gender, dictated gender roles, roles that are dictated by society, and they have a bit of a reaction to strapping a cock on, okay? So I have no idea if your wife might be one of these, but that might be something that she brings up or a suggestion you can ask her if you are curious and she's not really volunteering a lot of information about why she's hesitant. This would be one of the questions to ask her. And again, along those lines, the toy that you have, let's see, the Tantus Fire. Let me take a look at that. Aha. So what I found when I went to check that out is it's not called the Tantus Fire, it's called the Tantus Flame. And that is a beginner kit, which is a pretty good one. It's a nice beginner kit. And that actually eliminates the next thing I was going to say, because for those of you listening who might be in a similar situation, I'll go ahead and elaborate. The toy that you chose was very, very realistic, which again could freak her out if that is not something that she wanted and or is comfortable with. The flame is not very realistic at all, so that is not a problem. Let's see, what other things can I think of that she might be hesitant of? Oh, well, we can go over into the other territory of it might be all about you. She might be concerned that if she fucks you, it will turn you gay. So that's another thing you can ask her. And once again, please be gentle about this and only start asking her questions if she's not really willing to volunteer a lot, because it's the only way you're going to find out what the problem is. So she might think it'll turn you gay. She might think that if she fucks you in the ass, you're going to want to do that and nothing else. These are all fears I've had expressed to me by other women who have written in. And let's see, what else can I think of? Express to her what you said to me. You find yourself craving it and you'd really like to do it again, because there's no shame in that. You found something incredibly pleasurable for yourself and it was amazing and you want to do it again. Be loud and proud about that. Please remember to totally rock her world sexually while all this is happening. So much so that she would feel compelled to give you what you want. Do not make this a one-sided thing where you're just asking for the pegging and you give her mediocre ho-hum sex. Do her very, very favorite things so that she will be encouraged to be just as good giving in game as you are, sir. Good luck with it and let us know how it goes. Okay, I think that's it for today. So you can follow me on Twitter at @Ruby_writer. You can like my Facebook page, and you can subscribe to my blog where there's all kinds of fun goodies and lovely pictures and things, and certainly a lot of very erotic things to read for the entire month of May that do not appear on my, well, they don't appear, but you don't hear about them either on my podcast. My podcast is available on iTunes, and it is also available to stream directly from my blog at peggingparadise.com. All you have to do is click the link right underneath the picture that says Pegging Paradise podcast number, whatever it is for that particular one. Just click that and it'll stream directly. You can send all your questions and stories to ruby@peggingparadise.com, or you can click the write Ruby links at the upper right of every page of my blog if you'd like to email me directly from my blog, or you can call me 805-500-6544. Thank you for downloading and listening, and happy pegging, everybody.